21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
Everybody needs a helping hand. Take a look at your fellow man and tell me what can I do today. Because everybody needs a helping out. If that ain't what it's all about, tell me what. What can I do? What can I do today?
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zohara Hieronymus. Laura Kortner is our executive producer, and Anna Caroline Caruso is running our board. Joining us this hour is a very world-renowned scientist, Dr. Dean Radin. Dean is chief scientist at the Institute for Noetic Sciences. His earlier books, Entangled Minds and the Conscious Universe, open the doors to current consciousness studies that cross disciplines. In his newest book, Supernormal, Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities, shows how the ancient traditions of Buddhism, Hinduism, and shamanistic cultures worldwide pointed to natural capacities within each human, which in laboratory studies reveal, yes, it is true, these practices do in fact create heightened awareness, vision, and knowledge of the world, if not the cosmos. Looking at shamans as the earliest healers, weather forecasters, psychologists, and storytellers, one finds their access to the supersensible realms is consistent with all mystic traditions and with modern provings in the labs worldwide, something Dr. Radin is famous for. Join us for a wonderful odyssey from the ancient yoga sutras and siddhi practices to telepathy, precognition, clairvoyance, and other capacities that help us navigate the world and our place in it. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Radin.
Oh, thank you very much for asking me to be on your show.
It's a beautiful book. I had the pleasure of reading it over a couple of days, and I'd like, if you don't mind, if we can just start with some basics about how research in the labs regarding these various states of consciousness help us better understand ancient cultures.
Well, from a Western secular perspective, when we, especially scientists, look at the stories about the ancient mystic masters of the East, those kinds of stories, they're very easily conflated with fairy tales and fantasy. And so the question is, are these stories about what the yogic masters were supposedly able to do, is there any truth in that at all? If it turns out that the answer is yes, and it means that modern science has done quite well in studying certain things, but not so well in studying other things. And the distinction is usually between the objective and the subjective worlds. So as a scientist, I have, of course, spent many years studying the objective external world. That's what science is good at. But I always had an internal sense that some of the ancient wisdom that has come down through the years, some of it probably is fantasy and some of it is probably embellishment. And there's always hagiography, the embellishment of the saints and that sort of thing. But I wondered if that was true for all of those stories. So fortunately, science is quite good at in terms of its method for studying even subtle subjective reports. And for now about 130 years, science has been applied to these subtle phenomena. We typically call them psychic phenomena, but there's a wide range of different kinds of experiences that the yogis had talked about. And as a body of evidence, the overall body of evidence, I think it's quite clear that at least the elementary supernormal abilities, as I call them, the elementary supernormal abilities are almost certainly true. And I say that I'm not going to say they're proven to be true because science is not really about proof. It's about gaining confidence in evidence. So I'd say we have very high confidence that some of the stories that have passed down over the years about what the yogis claimed is true. And that means we have missed something in modern science, but not everyone has missed it. I mean, there are small group of scientists throughout the years who have been interested in these same questions that I have, and collectively I think we have demonstrated that there's still quite a bit to go before we have wrapped up our theory of the universe.
And some of the cities, I mean, maybe we can talk a little bit about the Hindu and the Buddhist tradition of yoga, even more of the Hindu, is that what we call in psi psychology or psi experiments is we look at things like extraordinary strength or knowledge at a distance or knowledge of the inner universe. Or I love this one, liberation from hunger and thirst in people who claim that they can live without eating. And we'll come back to that later. But I think it might be helpful to look at precognition as just an example, because you've done lab work on that, and I think everybody's had some sort of flash of intuition in their life. How does paying attention to what we see, to what we note, impact our ability to perceive in these more sort of etheric realms, or in these, I guess we'd call them other dimensions in which we have existence?
Well, so let me give a little context for this.
Okay.
When you read the classic book of yoga, written by the Indian sage Patanjali some 2,000 years ago or so, he lists in his description of what up to that time had been an oral tradition. So he wrote down the oral tradition. This becomes the classical book of yoga, the Yoga Sutras. And part of that tradition is that you, in the process of doing yoga and meditation, you gain certain super abilities. And in Sanskrit, the term is siddhi, S-I-D-D-H-I. And it simply means attainment or perfection as a result of meditative practice. And so he gives a list of about 25 different siddhis that the student is able to learn. And the very first one, which you might think of as being the most elementary siddhi or power that is developed as a result of meditation, is what we would call precognition. The way it's actually translated is awareness of past, present, and future all at the same time. So if we have awareness of the past, we might call that memory. If we have awareness of the present, we call it awareness. If we have awareness of the future, well, now we're talking about precognition. So this is the most elementary, or the first thing that students of meditation would bump into. And the way that it would express among most people would probably be in the form of synchronicities or as extended deja vus. You'd simply have a sense that your awareness is expanded through time. So one of the things we did, and we've done many experiments along these lines, but just to give an example, when you talk to long-term meditators, one of the things they often report is when they're deep in meditation, they experience what they might call spaciousness. They get a sense of expanded self in space. But they also will sometimes report a timelessness, that they feel as though they're extended through time. So extension through time sounds very much like what Patanjali was talking about, awareness of past, present, and future. So we decided to test this claim, or at least this experience, in the laboratory with highly experienced meditators, and with controls. These are people who had never meditated. And the task that we did in the laboratory was ridiculously simple, but effective. It simply consisted of recording the meditators or the non-meditators' brains. We used 32-channel EEG system. While they see light flashes or they hear audio tones that happen at random times. And what we're interested in is not how the brain responds to the stimulus, but how the brain responds before the stimulus. And in particular, does the brain respond differently before you're about to see a light flash as compared to hear an audio tone? So this has no semantic meaning to it. It's simply a response to a simple stimuli. So if it is true that the sense of timelessness means that some part of your awareness is spread out through time, and perhaps given that we know that the brain responds differently, different sections of the brain respond to light and to sound, that perhaps your brain would show a difference in its behavior before seeing the two different kinds of stimuli. So that's what we did. The meditators showed that effect very clearly about a second and a half before a randomly selected light flash or an audio tone, the meditator's brain showed a very clear difference, whereas the non-meditator controls showed no difference. So that's the kind of somewhat artificial task that we use in the laboratory, but it gives us very high confidence that when a meditator says they feel like they're extended through time, as Patanjali wrote many years ago, it turns out that we can objectively measure that that is in fact the case.
And I remember, I don't remember who I was talking with about the experiment, but it had to do with, maybe it was in the Duke experiments a long time ago, or that this precognitive awareness happens before negative, or what we call negative or hurtful or dangerous things are going to happen, that within 5 seconds before it happens, or 7 seconds, I think it was, we know it. So it's a similar kind of precognitive awareness. Is that right?
Well, that's an unconscious form of precognition I call presentiment.
And you talk about that a lot, the presentiment and how you measure what kind of impact or effect it has.
Right. So this is a kind of experiment that I started in the mid-1990s, and it was a physiological way of measuring before it actually reaches conscious awareness, can we detect in the body that you're about to receive an emotional shock versus no emotional shock? And so there, very similar to what I just described with the meditators, instead of presenting something as simple as a light flash or an audio tone, you present pictures that are very emotional or very calm in a random order. And what we're able to see in those studies is that between about 3 and 9 seconds before you see the stimulus, your body responds appropriately for what the upcoming stimulus is. So if you're about to see an emotional picture and we're measuring something like heart rate, then roughly 9 seconds before the picture appears, your heart rate decelerates, which is a stress response.
Mm-hmm.
If we're measuring skin conductance, it's about 3 seconds before. If you're measuring the brain, it's about 1 second before. So these differences in time are reflective of how fast the nervous system is responding, not so much about anything specific about precognition, but just simply we're measuring the body, and the body has different response times.
The sensitivity to the world around it. You know, I've often wondered if overexposure to, say, violent images or to playing violent video games, as children do, and they often do it for years and years and years, whether or not it takes away that kind of sensitivity so that there's this disassociation then when a person exposed to that kind of violence and trauma disassociates themselves from it, and then neurophysiologically doesn't even feel the pain they cause others when they go on one of these random shooting sprees or beheading people. What do you think about that, this overexposure to violent stimulation?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that if you're exposed to a lot of violence, you become inured to it. That you simply won't respond the same way because you've become used to it, and you can't respond the same way each time to a strong stimulus. You just simply accommodate to it. So the question is, do you also then, from a precognitive sense, do you become inured to strong violence? And I suspect that the answer is yes.
Which always is what's concerning.
We actually tested this somewhat by having pictures, for example, of some of our emotional pictures that we use are things like automobile accidents and houses on fire and that sort of thing, which for most people, you'd have a pretty big response. But some of the people that we've tested are firemen and policemen and first responders who are not exactly used to seeing these things, but it doesn't freak them out in the same way that it was for someone who's not used to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't show the same kind of response as somebody who's not used to it. So there's a bit of evidence suggesting that you're right, that if you become used to certain kinds of emotional events, and this, by the way, is both positive or negative emotional events, that your response to it coming at you from the future, so to speak, is not quite as strong.
Right. And then when you study, as I have in the past, military mind control, that's exactly what they do to make somebody inure to doing things that are pretty traumatic or devastating to others. And you see it sometimes in scientists who have completely disassociated from the trauma they cause to the animals they experiment on.
That's right. Right.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take a look at the value of meditation and yoga and why the two were combined versus sort of the booming industry of yoga in the West. Our guest is Dr. Dean Radin. His book, Supernormal, Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. It's a Deepak Chopra book 2013 release. Follow Dean at www.deanradin.com.
Hi, this is Dixie Molyneux, and my practice at the Ruscomb Mansion is called Happy Calm Acupuncture, and I invite you to come and experience the beautiful healing modality of acupuncture. You can find me at the Ruscomb website, which is ruscombe.org, and you're now listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zohara Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Dr. Dean Radin is our guest. Follow with his work at www.deanradin.com. Dr. Radin is the chief scientist at the Institute for Noetic Sciences, www.noetic.org. And in fact, we will be having the president and CEO of Noetic Science Institute on March 29th, 2015. Cassandra Vitan, I think is how she pronounces her name. So, Dean, in your book, before I come back to yoga and meditation, you talk about, you know, this aboriginal otherworldliness of shamanism, and then, quote, "But when the exciting tales of other realities touch through these practices, or supernormal powers evoked by them are soberly presented as real, the only sounds heard in the sedate halls of academia are the echoes of footsteps scurrying away." And then you gave this very recent example, which I was really surprised that we still are that far away from people looking at this stuff. There was a recent paper by Daryl Bem, was it, at Cornell in 2011. So why this academic fear of things that have already since the 70s? You all have done a masterful job in the labs for 40 years.
You're asking why in the academic world is academic freedom more of a myth than a reality?
That's put even better.
Yeah. The answer is that academia, like any human enterprise, is a social activity. And in any social activity, there are certain things you can talk about, and there are certain things you can't talk about. And so in academia, has developed a certain ideology, a certain way of viewing the world. And there's an agreement that there are certain things you simply don't talk about. And so up until very recently, the notion that science and spirituality might have a common core was strictly taboo. You could not talk about that either from a scientific perspective or a scholarly perspective and get tenure. You simply would not remain in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's simply the way it is. It's that way in most academic places around the world. And, of course, the surprising thing, to me at least, was I can sort of understand why, from a scientific perspective, scientists are very dubious about religion. But among religious scholars, I'm not talking about people who are religious and in doing scholarship, but rather people who study religion, who maybe have no religious basis at all, but they're simply interested in as a human enterprise, that among religious scholars and historians of religion, when they are addressing the notion of the possibility that some of the supernormal tales that form the basis of many religions, they will dismiss them as purely superstition. That's the prevailing view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the view that is acceptable to talk about in the academic world, both from the scholarship side and, as I said, in the scientific side. So when evidence comes along that says, well, maybe some of those shamans were actually correct, and maybe the tales of the mystics are not complete fantasy, well, that's not admitted. You're not allowed to talk about it. And as a result, any evidence that is brought to bear, scientific evidence suggesting that some of that is true, you can't talk about that either. So, I mean, it sounds ridiculously simple, but that is exactly what happens.
No, we've seen it. Our program for almost 30 years now has really specialized in exactly this, which is the knowledge filter that the politics of the industry of education and the academies and, you know, whoever underwrites the research and gives the grants. We've looked at it with all the way from giants to little people to the 2 billion year old proof of humanoid activity on the planet. I mean, there's so many fields. I can't think of one we haven't covered where this kind of filter and obstruction isn't placed on securing better knowledge. So one of the things I mentioned, though, in that sentence earlier was the research in 2011 by Daryl Bem at Cornell. I thought it was just an excellent example of how this really happens to people that are so qualified to do the work they're doing.
Right. So what you're talking about is a kind of implicit precognition test that Daryl Bem helped to develop. And this involved something, it's a reversal, a time reversal of something that social psychologists study all the time. What a social psychologist looks at in one of the primary experimental methods is what's called priming. And so if you are primed to feel thirsty by looking at pictures of desert scenes, perhaps, even without consciously being aware of it, if they happen to be pictures on the wall, say, and when you go into a room and you have the opportunity of having a drink, you're much more likely to have a drink because you're going to feel thirsty because you were implicitly primed to feel thirsty by looking at the desert pictures. As compared to if you saw lots of pictures of the ocean, maybe you wouldn't feel quite so thirsty. So that's a very simplistic description of priming, but that's basically what it's about.
Or think about it from the point of view of all advertising.
Yes.
Basically,
exactly.
That's what advertising is. It tells you what to do, when to do it, and why to do it.
Right, and mostly at an unconscious level.
Right, exactly.
It's more powerful at an unconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
So the usual way of doing this experiment is you prime somebody, and then you do some kind of a test. That's the ordinary forward time way of doing priming. What Daryl did is simply reverse the process. He would have somebody do a behavioral task, and then he would prime them. So by reversing the task, if it turned out that when people are asked to do some sort of task that they ended up preferring what they were later be primed with, it would suggest that somehow the arrow of time had reversed. So he did 6 variations of experiments like this and repeated them and ended up with odds beyond 1 billion to 1. After running 1,000 student subjects in these experiments at Cornell, and he published a paper in a very high-impact journal, and it caused a huge outcry. And among other places in the New York Times, the title of the op-ed was "To Prepare to be Outraged," which I thought was great because the paper hadn't even been published yet.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a precognitive "Prepare to be Outraged,"
mm-hmm.
which is sort of ironic.
Mm-hmm.
So the paper was published, and sure enough, it produced probably hundreds of news articles on this, and lots of reaction by other academics saying this can't possibly be so, and if this is published, then we have to question everything we know about psychology and about statistics and about everything else. And this is just one example of many historically where somebody manages to publish an article in a mainstream, high-impact journal, and it produces a very predictable backlash where actually a fairly small number of scientists get extremely upset that the journals would dare to publish something which they assume cannot be so. And again, it's reflective of the social taboo against talking about these topics.
So many topics. I mean, if we were to list all the topics we've covered on 21st Century Radio, you'd discover probably 95% of them are taboo, each in their own field. One of the things that has interested me over the decades, Dean, and many of the quantum physicists who have joined us over the years have explored this with us. And the question I wanted to ask you about was, whether you think consciousness is responsible for the formation of reality, meaning is what we think we're going to see, what we believe we can see, what our mindset is, have to do with forming the reality we will experience?
Well, it is one interpretation of what's happening in quantum mechanics, so-called quantum observer effect. But that is oftentimes inflated to an extent which is probably not true. So just to give an example, the book and the movie The Secret, which follows on a long tradition of power of positive thinking and so on, I think there's a kernel of truth in the idea, but at least within the laboratory, when we measure the effect of observation on quantum systems, the magnitude of the effect is really small, very, very small fraction of 1%. And that suggests that there is something peculiar about the act of observation that does change the physical world, but it doesn't appear to be big enough to make massive differences, at least not quickly. What it does suggest is that focused intention over extended periods of time, perhaps not just with one person but with many, that might change probabilities of events that are about to occur. And as a result, the future would be somewhat different as a result of all of this focused attention than it would be if there wasn't that focused attention.
Right, and there'd be a bigger wave, we would assume, if a group of people were doing it. I remember when I talked to Bill Sweet at the Spindrift Institute over many years about the effectiveness of prayer, and after it was mung beans and fruit fly larvae and this and that, they discovered that the most effective impact was not people projecting their will or their idea of what was restoration, of whether it was a physical system or a thing, but to sort of release it to divine right order, and that the impact was greater. What about that kind of impact of when we're willing to sort of let go of our, I guess one could say, our ego or our own sense of what's best for Aunt Martha who's fallen down the steps versus releasing it to the divinity or to the whatever that power is or whatever that universal wisdom is, and it having a bigger impact? And that's what they found when they measured prayer.
Well, it's a tricky question because the laboratory studies suggest that intention does matter, but effortless attention, effortless driving, as they sometimes use in meditation. You must meditate with every fiber of your being, but without any ego involvement at all, which sounds like a contradiction in terms. You have to try like crazy, but not try at the same time. So that suggests something like a release of the ego, which, by the way, fits in very nicely with the whole yogic tradition as well, that ego gets in the way of advancement in yoga and meditation. Whether that has anything to do with the divine is something that we can't answer from a scientific perspective. We don't know. But at least from the point of view of what seems to work in experiments that involve mind-matter interaction, the more focused attention with the least amount of ego involvement seems to work the best. So that would be consistent with what the people at Spindrift had found, but they interpret it in a religious way.
Interesting. Yeah, because they're Christian scientists. It's just fascinating. Now, psychokinesis in living systems is one of your chapters, and maybe we'll take, Laura, do we need to take a break? No, we have time. So let's talk a little bit about that. Maybe you could highlight some of the important points for us. I don't know, like the impact of prayer and healing or other things that are related to it.
Yeah, studying prayer on healing is exceptionally difficult. And so we've done clinical trials, we've done experiments in the laboratory, and the problem that happens is if somebody is actually in need of healing, you don't have much control as a scientist on who is providing the healing. Like, you know, someone is seriously ill, well, their family members and their friends and everyone else is going to be sending them healing thoughts and intentions. And so you can't have a good control condition. There's no way to turn the healing off. So what we've tended to do more in the laboratory is to select people who will basically play the role of a patient, but may or may not have any major healing need, or at least that within the laboratory context, they're healed and they get healing thoughts sent to them at specific times. And by doing that, you can look at changes in their physiology rather than in healing outcomes. Because if you're trying to measure healing outcomes, it takes a long time, and it's not so easy to measure healing outcomes. But measuring physiological changes is rather simple and quick. So we're able to show that one person's intention, their compassionate intention sent towards another person, has an impact on their sympathetic nervous system and their parasympathetic nervous system and their central nervous system. And you see this as a result of changes in heart rate and changes in skin conductance and brain waves and so on. So we know in principle that directing your beneficial thoughts towards someone at a distance will affect them. Whether it has a healing outcome is another issue. And that, if you look at the literature, it is not clear that it has a healing outcome. It has an effect, but healing is another issue.
I thought there was that enormous study done of heart patients out on the West Coast a long time ago. I don't remember the gentleman's name. Somehow or other, the name Bird is coming to my head, but I don't think that's what his name was.
And that is correct. Randolph Bird.
Well, I do remember. Shocking. Sometimes so surprised that my data bank is still retrievable. And they actually found that the patients, and they did it through people not knowing who was being prayed for, and the patients didn't know if they were being prayed for. And the cardiac patients that were prayed for had less infection, quicker recovery, and better outcome, as I recall.
Yes. But there, since then, have been a number of other studies, probably another dozen or so. And when you look at the cumulative database, including a very large study done at Harvard a number of years ago, you either get no results, or in a few cases, you get results that are opposite. You get that the people who are being prayed for actually did worse.
Never heard that. Fascinating.
Yeah. That's why there's no consistent effect on the study of prayer. But as I said, on the study of something like Reiki as a method, mm-hmm. or therapeutic touch, and a few other of the so-called non-contact therapies, there the evidence is clearer that it's no longer intercessory in a religious sense,
right?
But simply close-up energy medicine-type healing that does seem to have an effect.
Exactly. We have Reiki at the emergency room here at the University of Maryland, and to think that that's come about is just an extraordinary baby step, but a good one. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Dean Radin. His beautiful new book, a Deepak Chopra 2013 release, Supernormal, Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. Follow up at www.deanradin.com, and also, because he's the chief scientist at the Institute for Noetic Sciences, www.noetic.org.
This is Dr. Larry Dossey. I'm the author of the recent book, One Mind, How Our Individual Consciousness is Part of a Greater Mind and Why It Matters. I hope you'll listen often to 21st Century Radio. Dr. Zoe Hieronymus talks about what matters. The subject matter is crucial. Our future may depend on it. And I hope you will follow me at my website, www.larrydosseymd.com.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. In fact, Brother Larry Dossey wrote on the back of our current guest book, Supernormal, quote, beautifully written. Supernormal is spiced with that rarest ingredient in Sias writing, humor. If this book does not take your breath away, it should, because it reveals how we can awaken to innate human potentials that are glorious and on which our future may depend. First caller at 410-922-6680, 1-800-WCBM-680. If you know the name of our current guest, you will be the winner of one of these wonderful books, and you'll be glad to have it. That's 1-800-922-6680 or 410-922-6680. So coming back to the questions that, you've addressed so many things, we can't obviously touch it all. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the issue of where this is all leading, because if we have all these wonderful capacities and they're beginning to be explored, and certainly since the 60s, many of our generations of men and women have continued to practice and develop their own capacities, how will this impact us in the future?
Well, of course, that's the big question. And one of the reasons why I focused on yoga and meditation in this book is because over the past 40 years, yoga and meditation have transitioned in the West from an exotic thing. that only crazy hippies did back in the 60s to something which crazy hippies did, but maybe there was something to it, to it looks like there might be some health benefits to meditating and doing yoga, to practices which are now paid by insurance. So we've gone from craziness to dead center mainstream. And an easy way to see this is by looking at how meditation and yoga have been covered on the cover of Time magazine. So it went from literally from crazy hippie psychedelic stuff to famous actors and actresses showing that they're meditating, and it's part of military programs for treating PTSD. So this has expanded the number of people who have been practicing meditation from probably a few hundred thousand to tens of millions in the West. Given that I know a little bit about the history of meditation and what happens as a result of disciplined practice, it occurred to me that what we're seeing is almost a behind-the-scenes transformation of society itself. That is not obvious, except if you look at it in historical terms. And you have tens of millions of people who are now doing practices that will lead in some people to advancement of their potential. Eventually, that starts to become a large number, and potential begins to grow. So I don't know what the magic number is where we exceed a threshold and suddenly everyone becomes enlightened. I think we're pretty far away from that. But it does begin to raise the possibility that as a civilization, that possibly some of the growing interest in healthier food and healthier practices and more alternative methods of health and all of the rest of the things that we can consider to be positive, some of that may be coming about as a result of this underground that is slowly beginning to get in better and better touch with its own consciousness, and as a result, higher potentials that we all are capable of. So that's my optimistic view of what's happening. And as I said, that's one of the reasons why I wrote a book that focuses on yoga and meditation.
Mm-hmm. And it is so fascinating because my own daughter was, you know, schooled in it and did. It's fascinating how many people have gone for training to teach yoga, and they may teach for a couple years, but it doesn't matter. They go and get certified. They spend an extraordinary amount of time learning postures. But my oldest daughter's been teaching for, I don't know, 25 years. And so you wonder about, though, the separation of yoga from meditation, which has concerned me, even talking about yoga as an Olympic sport, like it's competitive. And the whole purpose of it was to lead to enlightenment and good health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, it is true that the Western focus is primarily on asana, the poses and the physical side of it. But I think even among yoga therapists and people who are going to yoga practice that are focusing on the body, there's always a meditative element to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like at the very end of a typical yoga session, there is a meditation, simply to relax and calm down. And the poses themselves are useful in getting your body stronger and able to meditate for longer periods of time. So it's a little like an opening. It's a door that opens in the direction of meditation, maybe something that's good for you as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say that when I give talks, not necessarily about this book, but just talks in general, and I ask people how many meditate, how many do yoga, what is their response to the experiences that I'm talking about, usually psychic experience, and the experimental results that we get, it's overwhelmingly positive. So the question is, are the people who are interested in yoga and meditation, do they already have that temperament? Or are they coming from it from all walks of life, many of whom may be entering into yoga because they have back problems or something, and they were very skeptical about psychic phenomena to begin with. Do they change as a result? Does their opinion change as a result of simply doing the practice? And the answer seems to be yes, it does.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, again, why I feel optimistic. Simply doing the practice, even though it's not the full-blown practice that you do at an ashram, it is a step in the right direction.
Exactly. I mean, anything that makes people more self-aware and more aware of the environment around them makes for hopefully a more compassionate and right-actioned world. One of the areas that interests me personally is telepathic communication and what I refer to as trans-species communication, because there's now a movement in psychology called trans-species psychology, which dumps all the old view of research and models on animals as not being different from humans. What do you think is taking place in trans-species communication, let's say between a person and an animal, even reading animals who might be 500 miles away?
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't that long ago, maybe 20 years ago, where the prevailing view within psychology was that animals didn't have emotions and animals basically had no awareness and, you know, all that stuff. That has pretty radically changed, partially as a result of experiments showing that gorillas and dogs and birds actually are much more intelligent than previously thought, and in some cases have self-awareness similar to what humans have. And so I think there are new generations of people, academics who are growing up and realizing that we're not all that different than what we might think of as animals that are not human. We have different capacities, of course, but on the other hand, you find in equine therapy with horses, for example, that horses are exceptionally sensitive to humans. Like, they've been bred that way for millennia to be sensitive to humans. And in working with someone who may have an emotional distress with a horse, the horse immediately mirrors what's going on. And so we have a study that we're planning now to do a study of what happens to your genes as a result of doing therapy with horses, given that the horses are like the perfect therapist that interacts with the patient or the client in a nonverbal way. So we think, based on reports that we hear, amazing reports of people who have equine therapy, that they're significantly improved as a result of working with a horse. So we're looking at the genetic change in people as a result of these therapies.
It's so interesting, because in the Kabbalistic tradition, we would talk about the animal soul and the divine soul, and the animal soul, which we also have within us, is our emotional component. And so for those of us who are telepathic with animals, it's through this deep love and emotional abiding. You know, I've had this theory that actually showed up in one of my own meditations, and I wonder what you have found, because now that you've mentioned DNA change, I have this understanding that our DNA zips and unzips between the new and full moon. And when you look at cultures worldwide and the kinds of honoring of the new moon, but all the rituals are on the full moon and the drumming and these things that kind of put you into a theta state. Has there been much research about the change of DNA through theta state consciousness? I mean, because it's kind of where you're headed with this equine research, because we certainly know, you know, of the biochemical reality of being with animals, the serotonin and the oxytocin and all these wonderful feel-good things that come out. But what about DNA and the moon?
I know nothing about that. It sounds very interesting, and when I get questions like this, I defer to my colleagues who actually know a whole lot more about this than I do.
Well, pass it down the line. I'd love to hear from somebody else who might have fallen on what I saw one day in meditation a number of years ago, because I try to even stay aware of my own life, that, you know, between the new and the full moon is a good time to build and go outwards and plant your seeds in life. And then between the full moon and the new moon is a good time to retreat and withdraw, because we are water beings and the tides have so much to do, I believe, with our DNA. Anyway, it's just a very personal thing. Another good thing you pointed to when we talk about these psi abilities are things like psychic detectives. And we know from remote viewing, the use of remote viewers for military, lost children, lost things. What are the things that interest you the most, Dean, personally?
Well, one project that I hope to begin shortly is looking at energy medicine. There are some people who are exceptionally good at healing. And there's a possibility that some aspects of what they do can be measured through electromagnetic and magnetic means. There hasn't been a whole lot of research on this, but there's a suggestion that there are what's called pulsed electromagnetic fields that are associated with what healers do. And if that is true, if we can confirm that we can pick up certain frequencies, certain magnetic effects, then the possibility arises that we can record those signals and then we can play them back. And the goal would be that if everything I just said, it turns out to be so, we could possibly make a machine that mimics what energy healers do and then create what amounts to a technology that is able to do what these expert healers do, but without having to rely on healers.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, this has been thought of, I guess, for the last 50 years, that this century would be the century of light medicine and color medicine and sound medicine, that we would finally realize we're biocapacitors of light and that there's ways to adjust the light intake and I guess, what would we call it, emanation as well.
Exactly. Yeah, and there are machines you can buy. There have been previous methods that have been used going back, as you said, about 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Our approach would be, I'm aware of the previous literature. I know something about the machines that have been built in the past. But we take an innocent approach and say, well, let's assume that some of that is real. Let's start with current technology, which is pretty good at picking up very subtle signals, and do it over again. We'll start with the best healers that we can find. We'll compare them with people who have no healing ability or don't know that they have ability, and do a very careful comparison to see if we're able to both pick up signals that have been claimed in the past and then reproduce them and measure to see whether those signals actually have an effect on living systems all the way up to healing humans. So that's a project that we hope to get underway shortly.
That's wonderful. Look, we're almost out of time, and I'm sure there's people in the audience going, well, what do we do with all of this? So what, somebody in the listening audience going, okay, so we've got these abilities, now what?
Well, if we all had the abilities at the level that the yogis had, we wouldn't need this conversation. I think what it's reminding us, though, is that we have capacities that are way beyond what is currently thought of as being possible. And there are some people out there who are probably very talented at these things who may not even know it. So my message basically is, if you haven't started a disciplined yoga or meditation practice, you should probably do it for very similar reasons as to why you would brush your teeth every day. It's simply a smart thing to do for your health and for both your mental and physical health. And it doesn't need to take hours a day. You don't need to go to an ashram, but just a little bit every day on meditation.
I want to thank you, Dean, for being with us. Supernormal Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities, www.deanraden.com.
Stay connected with stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Lucero. A video released by...